Amos Oz is the Israeli peace activist and Israel's most acclaimed novelist. He was co-founder of the Peace Now movement in 1997, and he's the recipient of many awards, including the Frankfurt Peace Prize. His work has been translated from Hebrew into 30 languages, and now he's published a new book. It's about growing up in Palestine and Israel in the 1940s and 50s. It's a richly detailed memoir of life in Jerusalem under the British in the shadow of the Holocaust and in fear of Arab attack. His parents had fled Eastern Europe in the early 30s. The book is called A Tale of Love and Darkness. It's become one of the biggest-selling literary works in Israeli history. In the United States, it's appeared on many lists of the best books of 2004, including the Washington Post, also in the Guardian of London. Amos Oz, welcome back to the program.
Well, it's good to be with you again.
Before we talk about your memoir, could we spend just a couple of minutes on the political situation in the Mideast?
Go right ahead, please.
What happens after Arafat? The head of Arafat's old guard from the days of exile in Tunis is Mahmoud Abbas. We're told there's little enthusiasm for him, especially among young Palestinians. I want to ask you especially about Marwan Barghouti, who's been in an Israeli prison for the last 4 years. Under five life sentences. He is now running for president from his jail cell. He's been described as the most popular and charismatic Palestinian leader, especially among younger people. Some describe him as the closest thing to a Palestinian version of Nelson Mandela, somebody who could make a deal with the Israelis and then sell it to the Palestinians. I wonder if you think that's true and what you think of Marwan Barghouti.
Well, I don't regard myself much of an expert on Palestinian leaders and Palestinian leadership. I have been in touch with many of the Palestinian peace activists and Palestinian peace movement, which is prominent and very courageous and very bold. And I think the important thing is that you find stronger and stronger subterranean pragmatic attitudes among secular Palestinians. In fact, I think the good news is that if you pass the referendum today, both in Israel and in Palestine, you will find that most Israelis and most Palestinians are unhappily ready for a two-state solution. Now, who will be the person who will lead this necessary solution on the Israeli side? Who will be the person on the Palestinian side? I don't know. But the one who will lead it will, by definition, become the great leader of the Israelis and the great leader of the Palestinians.
The next big thing in Israeli-Palestinian relations, of course, is the Israeli pullout from Gaza, a disengagement, they call it, which is scheduled to take place over the next 9 months. Seems like a historic development, the first large-scale Israeli withdrawal from Palestinian territory occupied after 67. What do you think is going to happen in Gaza after the Israelis pull out? Of course, I'm interested in Hamas, which is based there. Last week, a Hamas leader announced that his group would accept a Palestinian state in the occupied territories in a long-term truce with Israel.
Well, if this is what they said, it's good news. I've been away from home for a week now, and a week in the Middle East is a long time.
Yeah.
But yes, as I said, I think it's dawning even on those people who object the two-state solution and regard it as a sacrilegious solution that this is unavoidable. There is no alternative. And even people who resent this solution know in their heart of hearts that it is impending. Gaza is a good step forward. I would have liked for the Gaza withdrawal, unilateral Israeli withdrawal from Gaza, to become part of a more comprehensive Israeli-Palestinian agreement. I would like Gaza to be not just abandoned to its fate, but handed over in an organized and orderly way to a Palestinian authority, perhaps temporarily backed by Egyptian troops, and with an international and United Nations endorsement of this Egyptian support for building a democratic Palestinian regime in Gaza. But all in all, it's a step in the right direction, no doubt.
And what would it take for Israel to carry out this negotiated handover instead of just walking out and throwing away the keys?
Well, I'm not yet utterly I haven't entirely despaired from a negotiated solution. It may still happen in the course of the next few months that Israel and Palestine will negotiate and find an a agreed solution as opposed to a unilateral withdrawal, and it will be much better for all parties.
Well, Amos Oz, let's talk about your memoir, A Tale and Love of Darkness. I found it an overwhelming book, so intense and detailed, it's almost dizzying. There's a lot more politics in this book than your other books, or at least more political history. When you were growing up in the 40s in Jerusalem, this is under the British Mandate, of course, your family were militant right-wing Zionists. You rebelled against that world when you were 15 years old and went to work on a kibbutz. That was 1954, when the State of Israel was only, 5 years old. Tell us a little bit about the political world of your family and what your rebellion meant.
Well, the political world of my family is in the book, all right, but The Tale of Love and Darkness is not a political book. It's not about Zionism, and it's not about left-wing and right-wing. It's essentially a family drama, which I think extend over four or five generations. It's a rendering of the enigmatic, mysterious marriage of two well-meaning, generous, kind people, my father and my mother, a marriage which ended in a colossal tragedy. The political consequences, the personal consequences, the fact that I left home and moved to a kibbutz are all but the repercussions of the Big Bang, of the tragedy of my family. Now, I tried to look into this tale in a very detailed way, and much of it is indeed a novelist's work, not a memoirist's work, because I had to invent a lot, I had to reconstruct a lot, and I had to orchestrate a lot. Politically speaking, it's not very much about my own reasons for deserting the right wing and moving to the left wing. It's more about the gap between the monumental and magnanimous dreams before the creation of the State of Israel, and the unavoidable degree of disillusionment after the state came into being. This is not so much about Zionism, it's about the nature of dreams per se. All dreams, all visions, all hopes and aspirations. Once they are fulfilled, they cannot be as wonderful as they were while they were still plans or blueprints or fantasies.
You know, I was very interested that when you went to the kibbutz, your father in particular was not enthusiastic about this, which I think would be surprising to American readers.
My father was an intellectual, lower middle class, right wing, bookish person. He wanted me to be, on the one hand, yes, he wanted me to be another intellectual, if possible bookish, highly educated, and so on. On the other hand, it was part of his own ambition for me, or another part of himself wanted me to become a soldier and a tractor driver. So even as I rebelled against him and defied his heritage and changed my family name and tried to be born anew and to be as different from my father as I could, I was nonetheless dancing to the music he dreamt of, or part of him dreamt about. Yes, he was a right-wing Zionist, so was my entire father's family. Militant, romantic, very 19th century European nationalist, not in a chauvinistic way, but in a liberal way. And they regarded kibbutz as an extension of Stalin, of communism. They were afraid of it. They were terrified by it.
The dream of Israel in your family before 1949 was a society that would be both very Jewish and very secular. What did you and your family think about the Orthodox who have become so powerful in Israeli politics today?
Well, of course, I don't come from a religious background, but I did go to an Orthodox school as a little boy in Jerusalem. I think the religious had not become very powerful in Israel. They have a leverage over the two major blocks, which are both secular, left and right. They have this leverage as long as there is a lasting stalemate between hawks and doves. But in terms of absolute political power, the various religious groups in Israel represented about 18% of the population when Israel became a nation, and they represent 18% of the population now. So it's an optical error to assume that Israel had become a more religious country. Jerusalem had become a more religious city, this is true. But this is not Israel. This is Jerusalem.
We're speaking with Amos Oz about his wonderful new memoir, A Tale of Love and Darkness. You know, today, official Israeli policy is so committed to toughness as the solution to all the issues with the Palestinians. I thought your book explains a lot about where this idea came from back in the 1940s.
You know, what my book, What a Tale of Love and Darkness, tried to present is the complexity of human situations. There are many conflicts in the world, individual and international, which are clear-cut and black and white, where you can simply march and wave slogans in favor of the good guys and arrange demonstrations against the bad guy and guys and express indignation. They exist, but I am less interested in such conflicts. The conflict between my mother and father, two very good and generous people. The conflict between Israelis and Palestinians, two former victims of Christian Europe in two different ways. Those conflicts excite me and interest me a lot more than those clear-cut goodies-baddies conflicts, which are so popular among some of the idealists in this country and in Western Europe.
I was very interested in just kind of the experience and the worldview of European refugee Jews who were living in Israel in the 1940s. What did you think was going to happen in Jerusalem in World War II?
Well, my parents, my family, they were devoted Europeans, secular Jewish Europeans who loved Europe at a time when no one else in the whole of Europe was a European. Everyone was a Bulgarian patriot or an Irish patriot. For being European, they were despised by the whole of Europe. They were labeled cosmopolitans. They were labeled ruthless intellectuals and parasites. They have not went to Palestine as a kind of ideological choice and certainly not as a colonialist enterprise. For them, Jerusalem was a life raft. They were not wanted anywhere. My parents, my family, other Jews in the milieu where I grew, well, the people who were thrown off the decks of the Titanic, Europe, not when this Titanic drowned itself in the 40s, but while all the lights were still on and the dining and the dancing and the singing was going on all the decks, and they were brutally thrown into the cold, dark ocean and had to metaphorically swim to Jerusalem because no one wanted them. There was no country in the world that would have taken in those 500,000 European Jews who settled in the land of Israel in the 1920s and 1930s. It was a life raft. So when people today bring up the subject, was Israel a wonderful idea or perhaps not? Was it too costly in regard to the suffering of the Palestinians and the Israelis? This is all totally false. It's as if my parents and my other members of my family went to a travel agency inquiring about a holiday resort, and they took the wrong turn. They should have opted for the French Riviera.
Yeah.
I have grown up in a family of unwanted people who carried with them to Jerusalem the open injury and insult of being kicked out by every European country and nation and unwanted by any other nation outside Europe. Every door was slammed in their faces. Every country said, we have too many Jews. We don't want you. So this is something that is crucial to the understanding of Israel as a refugee camp. Palestine is also a refugee camp. The conflict between Israel and Palestine is a conflict between two deeply injured refugee camps, which makes it so tragic and so complex and so far removed from being black and white. I am a son of unwanted refugees, survivors, who were fortunately for them thrown out of Europe, because if they would not have been thrown out of Europe in the 30s, they would have been killed by Europe in the 1940s. The same, by the way, applies to about 1 million Israelis, Israeli Jews, who were kicked out of the Arab countries and of the Islamic countries in the 40s and came to Israel and developed the same love-hate relationship with the Arab world that my parents conducted with Europe.
Amos Oz, your book, A Tale of Love and Darkness, you call a memoir, but you also suggest that many of the issues and indeed the facts in your book were things that your parents never spoke of. How did you put this together? And it seems to be a completely a factual record of your family history, as you say, over many generations. But you've sort of suggested here that's not quite right.
No, the subtitle memoir was put on the jacket by my publishers because of the classification needs of the Library of Congress. They don't recognize what I define this story in the title itself, a tale. Library of Congress doesn't recognize a tale as a literary form, although it's the most ancient literary form. Tales existed long before novels and short stories and so on. So the publishers added the word the memoir. I don't call it a memoir. I call it a tale. And as I said, much of it is the work of a novelist. I was like this paleontologist who had to reconstruct from very little, from some fossil little bone, the entire extinct creature. And the tale of love and darkness is projection and imagination and reconstruction and, yes, scraps of memory. Many of the painful issues in the lives of my parents were not discussed in front of the child. They would not talk to me about the fact that their relatives were being murdered in Europe in the 1940s. It was not for the child to know. They would not talk to me about the fears that the same was going to happen to the Jews in Jerusalem once the British administration pulled out and we will be left to the mercy of the Arabs. They would not discuss it. They would not discuss their hurt feelings vis-a-vis Europe. But it was in the air. I could sense it. I had my clues little signs and omens, and I reconstructed a tale of love and darkness, really as a monument to the generation of my parents. It's not my memoir. It's their story. I am just a supporting character in the story of my father and my mother.
Amos, as we've only got a couple of minutes left here, you said on the one hand, your father wanted you to be a person of the world of books and writing and intellectual life, and you went off to the kibbutz at age 15 to become the other kind of Jew, the strong and silent kind of Jew. Today, you are a person of books and intellectual life. I guess we should say that you fulfilled your father's dream.
Well, paradoxically, my rebellion against him ended up fulfilling more or less everything he wanted from me. I live in a room full of books and I write more books, which is part of his dream. And I have been a tractor driver and a soldier, which is another part of his dream. The one thing he would not at all like if he were alive are my politics, which he would still regard as red or dovish or leftist. But where would my father and I be without a healthy argument? We thrived on argument.
Well, one last question about getting back to politics just for 1 minute. You know, so much of the news from the Mideast is bad. Is it naive or foolish to ask if there's any hope for some good news?
Well, the good news is that the two nations are ready and prepared for a clenched teeth compromise. This is the overwhelming important development, which is not reflected at all in the daily news.
Amos Oz, thank you for the news. Thank you for your book, A Tale of Love and Darkness, and thanks for talking with us today.